This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of The New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. On a July night in 1969, I was in summer camp with a whole bunch of kids, and we watched as a counselor dragged a big black and white television outside. And amidst the mosquitoes and all the rest, we sat on the ground and watched two astronauts walk on the moon. Me and about 600 million other people watched two men walking on the surface of the moon. It was the most incredible thing, but as remarkable as that event was, maybe just as amazing is how many people refuse to believe it. To this day, people say that the space voyage was faked, an elaborate hoax engineered by NASA for some sort of nefarious purpose. And in some accounts, the fake footage was directed by none other than Stanley Kubrick. Generally, when I'm trying to understand something that outlandish and something that's all over the internet, I call on Andrew Marantz. He's a staff writer who reports for us on politics, extremism, and social media. So some sources say that 20% of Americans, 20%, believe the moon landing never happened. So this is something that goes way back. It obviously predates social media. Where does it come from? What do we know?
So I think there were skeptics from the moment that the footage was being beamed back to Earth, right? There were people watching that broadcast and saying, nah, I don't buy it. Doesn't seem real. And actually, there's this really interesting passage in Bill Clinton's autobiography, My Life, that actually a lot of the moon hoax conspiracy theorists will point to, where he talks about, I think he was back in Arkansas working construction for the summer or something, and he talks to this kind of curmudgeonly older carpenter guy, and he says, hey, what do you think? You know, we just landed on the moon. This is, you know, summer of 1969. And the carpenter goes, do you really think that happened? And young Bill Clinton says, yeah, I'm pretty sure it happened. And the carpenter says, I don't know. Those television fellers could do whatever they want to do. They can make things seem real that aren't real. And then Bill Clinton, in this kind of ironic touch, says, you know, I thought he was a crank back then, but after 8 years in Washington, I think he might have been onto something. So the conspiracists will point to that as evidence that, you know, a president is confessing to this great hoax that he's sort of been clued into since he was in the White House. My read of that is these people, these skeptics, have always existed, but all they could really do in 1969 was talk to the guy next to them on the job. They couldn't go out on Facebook and, you know, blast their theories to the world.
My understanding is that these rumors percolate for about 6 or 7 years. And then in 1976, there comes along a self-published book by someone named Bill Kaysing called We Never Went to the Moon, America's $30 Billion Swindle. Who is Bill Kaysing, and what was the theory that he was putting forward?
So he was a guy who worked for a rocket manufacturing company many years before he puts out this book. And he claims that he saw these classified NASA documents that proved that this never happened. His evidence, I don't think it will entirely surprise you to learn, is not rock solid. There's, for instance, this iconic image of the flag, the American flag being planted on the moon. If you think back to that image, you have a mental image of that. The flag is waving, right?
Yeah.
that seems like it should be impossible because there's no atmosphere on the moon. So what wind is it waving in? And there are dozens and dozens of things like this. There's a photo where, you know, it looks like the astronaut should be in shadow, but instead the astronaut is fully lit. People will say that's because it was on a soundstage. There's, I mean, literally dozens of these things. And there has been a kind of cottage industry of people, you know, knocking down these rumors one after another, NASA and other people, essentially since this book came out.
What kind of exposure did he get?
Yeah, so he didn't get much right away. He publishes this book in 1976. It's a self-published book. You know, it's sort of in this long tradition of people writing pamphlets that have wacky ideas in them that don't really have a huge impact on the culture. And it kind of just sits there and slowly percolates for a while, essentially until 2001. Fox puts out this documentary called Conspiracy Theory, Did We Land on the Moon?
Tonight,
liftoff. We have a liftoff.
We investigate the most extraordinary event of the 20th century.
They pose it as a question. They say this is controversial material. We don't know what's true or not true. And their main source, their main talking head for this, was Bill Casey.
Could the government have orchestrated the deception of the century?
NASA could have pulled off the greatest hoax of all time.
You be the judge.
So it's a little bit Trumpian. It's a little bit like, you know, a lot of people say, or I've heard
exactly
that.
Many people are saying,
yeah,
right, many people are saying, and like the Trumpian impulse, the impulse is to shock and titillate. I mean, Fox has been the most ratings conscious, the most clever about getting stuff out there since its inception. And even then, you know, this was a big moment for the hoax theory, but as big as that exposure was, it was still just a one-time event. But then, you know, you move forward in time to the current decade when you have YouTube and all kinds of social networks, Facebook, you know, these things that kind of where you can get these feedback loops, these echo chambers, these rabbit holes. I don't know exactly how this kind of theory got started, but the theory develops that Stanley Kubrick, the director of The Shining, had also directed 2001: A Space Odyssey. 2001 A Space Odyssey came out a year before the moon landing. And after The Shining comes out in 1980, there is a small but passionate cohort of people who believe that The Shining was Stanley Kubrick's secret confession to having been part of this secret government conspiracy. And there are reams of material. And so I think a great example of the YouTube version of this stuff is this very homemade looking documentary called The Shining 2.0, or sometimes it's called The Shining Code 2.0. And it's basically this one guy who it seems like just sat down with a bit of editing software and made this extremely in-depth examination, I guess you could say, exegesis.
Jack Nicholson plays the lead character Jack Torrance in The Shining. Jack represents the director Stanley Kubrick and his experience with NASA in producing and directing the Apollo 11 moon mission.
You're basically watching him freeze frame on The Shining, write words in text on the screen. And it's essentially this for every bit of The Shining.
The eagle sitting on the windowsill between the number 11 represents the Apollo 11 lunar module, the Eagle.
Wow. So it's a real La La Land.
Yes. This is extreme. I mean, this makes Bill Casing look like a rocket scientist.
Where is the moon landing conspiracy theory at today? Who still believes this and why?
Look, it's impossible to put exact numbers on this, but there are a lot of people who believe things like this. And in fact, it's not just, you know, random cranks. There are people who believe this who have huge platforms. A good example is Joe Rogan, who has arguably the most popular podcast in the world. He's a comedian. He's interested in, you know, fighting, mixed martial arts fighting. He's not quite a denialist that we landed on the moon, but he's definitely hoax curious, and you can hear him on his show doing this again and again.
You can theoretically jump higher, and if you believe in NASA, bro, there's some videos of guys jumping around on the moon.
Yeah.
The problem with the videos of people on the moon is that there are videos that look 100% fake.
So you're still wavering on whether we went to the moon?
I'm too dumb and uneducated to really know, right. But I am wavering more on the possibility that some of the footage was faked.
He's obviously deeply intrigued, you could say, but he also has enough kind of distance and kind of self-ironic, you know, posture to know that this is wacky stuff.
It sounds like it's good for business.
It's good for business. That could be it. Or it could be a combination of that and also that he wants to maintain his right to be skeptical. You know, there is this kind of fundamental thing that we have as humans, as Americans, we particularly in the press, you know, we like to be skeptical of claims. And, you know, frankly, some of the best art, comedy, investigative journalism certainly comes out of that skepticism, comes out of not believing the official narrative of something. So it's an impulse that I think is really helpful in a lot of cases. It's just a question of how far do you take it.
So conspiracy theories are all over the place in many different political contexts, but right now they're often associated with the alt-right. You have QAnon, Pizzagate. Why is this kind of stuff so attractive to that particular political group?
I think there are a lot of people who don't like the way things are going for them. A lot of people who really thought that they were going to support Trump and Trump was going to come in and drain the swamp. And it doesn't really seem like he's doing it. And so they need to come up with a theory, in many cases, an extremely outlandish theory to explain why what they wanted to happen is actually happening. It's just not visible on the surface. So QAnon is a perfect example of this, right? You have a lot of people who the basics of it is Trump is actually cleaning out all the corruption and all the alleged, you know, pedophile rings and all these really deep, dark things. He just doesn't want us, the American public, to know about it yet. So he's doing it in secret. The Jeffrey Epstein arrest is a big part of this, most recently, but this goes back way before that. Pizzagate was part of it where there was this allegation that Hillary Clinton's campaign manager was running a secret sex trafficking ring. Basically, there are these dots that people will connect that to them, they've built up this kind of internally cohesive world where these are secret breadcrumbs that the Trump administration is dropping to them to let them know we're taking care of stuff behind the scenes. We will reveal it all to you and everything will be okay, but we just have to take care of it first behind the scenes.
Andrew, are there conspiracy theories on the left of politics as well? What do those look like?
Oh, definitely. You know, 9/11 conspiracies generally are the domain of the left. And I should say, you know, all the allegations about Putin interfering with the 2016 election, it is, literally speaking, a conspiracy theory. It's one that has a lot of evidence behind it, but, you know, not all the evidence has panned out. Some of the things in the Steele dossier were borne out by evidence. Some of them were not. And there are definitely people on the left who took everything in that dossier as gospel inadvisedly, and they were proven wrong. So the human mind can make up a conspiracy theory about anything it wants to.
How much does it matter whether or not people believe that we went to the moon in 1969?
I think it matters in the sense that, you know, we have to live in a shared reality. It's fine to have an academic exercise where you go, how do I know what's really true? And how do I know what The Shining is really about? And how do I know that your blue is my blue? I mean, I think that stuff is really all to the good. The question is, can we ever get down off of that academic perch and come down to some shared ground truth where we say, you know what? I think that the report that the CBO just put out is basically true. Or if I think it's not true, I have reasons for that. And, you know, you can listen to my reasons and I can listen to your reasons. Like, if we can't do that, it's very hard to have a republic.
Now, it seems to me that not only do we have a president who has no problem propagating racism from the White House as much, the most in years since, say, Woodrow Wilson, but we also have a president of the United States who, even if he's not repeating conspiracy theories as absolute truth, he is gesturing toward his sympathy with them, whether it has to do with UFOs, whether it has to do with a sympathy with Alex Jones. How has that affected the whole politics that we think of as Trumpism?
Yeah, it's a big part of it. He does overtly signal that he doesn't really believe that vaccines are good for you. there's the individual level of that, which is, you know, his supporters can sort of find comfort in his denial of facts that are inconvenient, climate change being the biggest and most important one. But there's also the larger atmosphere that that creates, which Hannah Arendt had this famous phrase, you know, in a totalitarian regime, nothing is true and everything is possible. So by just attacking the very notion of facticity, the very notion that you even could ever know information about the world, you know, you're not only rebutting one particular claim, you're creating a set of conditions where you can say anything. And then as an authoritarian figure, you can use that to your advantage.
So you've done a very good job of sketching out the history and the problem. How do we fix it all?
I think you just pass a bill in Congress and it should take care of itself. No, I don't think it's that simple. I think, you know, I think about this stuff, you know, I think a lot about the kind of informational morass we're in and this moment where nobody knows what to think or what to say about anything. I think of it like a, you know, like the opiate crisis or like the climate crisis. It's a big, complex tangle of things. And like any of those issues, it's going to take a lot of different approaches to get out of it. So I think, you know, we have to figure out what to do about big tech, whether they need to be regulated, whether they need to be broken up, whether they need to just be, you know, better understood and, you know, people need to find ways to interact with them in a more healthy way. Education is a big part of it. News literacy, you know, it sounds sort of on the nose, but I think it would help if people knew kind of how the news was put together. I also think that just kind of reducing inequality and reducing the conditions that make people feel alienated and afraid and frankly angry at any institution that has any sway over their lives would indirectly, but I think very meaningfully, combat this. But I think the key thing is we're really just at the beginning of dealing with the most outward symptoms of this. You know, we see someone come along who is breaking the rules of this or that social network, and, you know, we say that person should be banned, and then that person is either banned from the social network or not. That is the end stage. That's the symptom. We're not getting to the underlying causes yet, and that we need to do that.
Andrew Marantz, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Andrew Marantz is a staff writer at The New Yorker, and he's been finishing up his book called Antisocial: Online Extremists, Techno-Utopians, and the Hijacking of the American Conversation. It's out this fall. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour, with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
In the ground floor apartment of a brownstone in the East 90s, at around 8:30, guests began to arrive for a moon-watching party being given by two young men just out of law school.
When three Americans headed toward the moon, and two of them landed and left the vessel to bounce around and collect rocks, they were watched on television by hundreds of millions of people back on Earth. And as that singular event took place, reporters from The New Yorker fanned out across the city to watch the people watching. Here are three accounts of that evening, published in The New Yorker in 1969.
The male guests, most of whom were young lawyers, were dressed in light-colored summer suits or in richly colored shirts. The ties were wide, but not flowery. The women, who seemed a few years younger, were in silky, bold patterned bell-bottom trouser suits.
Just 50 minutes from now, well within the hour, the moon is due to have visitors from another planet.
The guests sat down on a sofa, on chairs, or on a mattress, which had been brought in from a bedroom. Conversation about the moon landing was restricted to jokes or brief comments. Many people seemed to want something to happen that was more exciting than what could really happen. "It would be great if they found an animal," one man said. "We've seen everything in simulation. They might as well do it all in simulation," a girl said. Several people said they were not sure whether the CBS simulation of the lunar module being shown at that moment was real or not. "Hey, these furry claws coming down the ladder," someone said. "No, coming out of a crater," said a girl. A telephone in the next room rang, and a young man went to answer it. When he returned, Walter Cronkite was saying, "Commander Armstrong is about to pull the ring that will give us our first live television coverage from the moon." The telephone rang again, and someone said, "Oh, let it ring." But another man, after hesitating, went to answer it. The landscape of the moon appeared on the screen. The man announced, "There's a girl up at the corner who can't find the party." The group was riveted to the screen in silence during Armstrong's descent to the ground. During his first steps and his first words, and during Colonel Aldrin's descent. Then there was some more joking.
"When we find the first moon men, we'll have to decide which ones to support. The ones from the south or the ones from the north. We'll have to send military advisors."
On the sofa, a couple began talking about a girl named Margie. Suddenly, Armstrong emerged with amazing speed from the black shadow of the lunar module into the brilliant sunlight. There was a sigh from the group, then it fell silent again for a moment.
"Boy, look at those pictures.
There's something interesting in a crater here," Armstrong called out.
A girl who was sitting on the floor began to tell about a friend of hers who had married a nun. "The nun was in the lecture course he was giving," she said. "He had her out of her robes and married in 2 weeks, and a year later she had twins." On the screen, Aldrin was loping in a circle on the surface of the moon. The girl looked up at the screen and cried out,
"Oh, I just don't believe it." "I'm used to it already," a young man next to her said.
"When you get blasé about people going to the moon, you know you've changed."
Headquarters of the National Broadcasting Company in Rockefeller Center, the central control room was hot and stuffy, being packed with people in shirt sleeves. The controllers worked at two tiers of equipment-laden consoles facing a wall covered with a formidable array of monitors. In the center of it sat the director, Tony Missouri, a bald man wearing a headset and a pink shirt. Executives of the news division occupied the second tier, and the center of this tier was occupied by the executive producer of the space unit, James Kitchell, a bushy-haired man wearing a short-sleeved black shirt. The voice of Frank McGee said, "Neil Armstrong's on his stomach, feet first, coming out." Masuri shouted to a technician responsible for the superimposition of titles on the screen, "Set me up. First live picture from the moon, baby." "Go to Houston," Kitchell said loudly. "And take it," Masuri cried. "Here it comes," Kitchell shouted. On the monitor appeared a ghostly, unclear yet unmistakable black and white image of the lower portion of a heavily suited astronaut. The control room was filled with cheers and clapping. "The foot," Masuri cried. "Put first step on the moon," Kitchell ordered. And then he said, "Wait, he's not on the moon yet. So far, he's just on the footpad." "That's okay," Masuri objected. "After all, what's the footpad connected to?" "The shin bone," someone said. There was some technician laughter. Armstrong's foot could now be seen raised as he tried mounting the lowest rung of the ladder. And then his voice could be heard. "The surface appears to be very, very fine-grained. It's one small step. Take it! First step on the moon!" Everything became very quiet in the control room as the ghostly figure touched what seemed like white rigging. It all looked like an old movie showing some frost-shrouded polar explorer standing by the bulwark of an icebound ship. "Start setting up a split screen with the White House and the lunar shots," Kitchell said. After a pause, he added, "It's unbelievable. Unbelievable." Armstrong's figure could be seen moving about the lunar surface as he tested his walk. He began walking with long, loping steps. "Look at that," Kitchell said, "galloping across the moon."
"Hello, Neil and Buzz. I'm talking to you by telephone from the Oval Room at the White House. And this certainly has to be the most historic telephone call ever made. I just can't tell you how..."
Then the president made his telephone call to the astronauts. The interchange went off the air, and for a few moments, before the television lights in the White House were extinguished, Mr. Nixon could be seen on the monitor disengaging a microphone he had about his neck. Donald Meany, a vice president of the NBC News division, remarked, "The picture is going everywhere in the world by satellite. I hear they're getting a great picture in Bucharest and in Belgrade. And you know, nobody has the inside track on seeing these pictures. The scientists in Houston, the president, all of us in this room, perhaps Serbian peasants, they're all seeing the same fantastic live pictures at the same time. Nobody any better than anybody else, really. Maybe that holds something pretty good for all of us."
In the Lincoln Bar at the corner of Lenox Avenue and 135th Street in Harlem, scarcely anyone was looking or listening when Armstrong placed his foot on the moon. A jukebox was blaring What the World Needs Now by the Sweet Inspirations. A man with his back to the television set and a highball in his hand was telling a group of his friends about a girl he had just treated to a huge Chinese dinner, who had declared on their way out of the restaurant that she now wanted a barbecue supper. "Man, I had to unload her," he said. "I didn't have enough left to put gas in my car." One of the customers reached out, touched him, and said, "Hey, buddy, they walking on the moon." The man with the highball put down his drink and walked out of the bar. When Colonel Edwin Aldrin climbed down to join Armstrong, the jukebox in the corner had shifted to, "I'm going to Chicago, sorry I can't take you." The bartender went and turned off the jukebox.
"Hey, leave that thing on, man," a male voice yelled. "We ain't care about no moon."
"I do," the bartender said, "and there's a few other people here that do too."
"Well, damn," the man said. "I hope those whiteys never come back. They might just decide to stay there, too."
"Nah," a female voice said. "You can be sure the white man don't want to live up there. It's got no gold, it's got no silver, it's got no oil. And ain't that what whitey wants? He don't want no part of all that rock up there."
The man whose girl had demanded the barbecue
came back, and started telling another group his story. "Be quiet," the barmaid said. "You're full of nothing but Seagram's gin, and I want to see the man walking on the moon." "Oh, hush, with your moon," he replied. "You believe any of that wild stuff?"
"You keep your New York joy. I'm going to Illinois just as fast as I can. You New York women think you make a fool of any man."
From the archives of The New Yorker, published in July 1969, those pieces were written by Jonathan Schell, Thomas Whiteside, and Jervis Anderson. And they were read for us by Christine Renee Miller and Peter Gross. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Fahamu Peku is an artist whose work has been seen in museums across the country. And maybe just as importantly, his paintings have appeared on television in shows including Empire and Black-ish. The men he depicts tend to strike exaggerated poses with sagging jeans and a cascade of colorful boxer shorts. Some are aggressively smoking cigars or holding Glocks. The works are complex statements about stereotype and identity. And Jelani Cobb, who's a staff writer at The New Yorker, is a big fan.
I've known Fahamu Peku for about 12 years. I actually have a painting of his that hangs on the wall in my living room, and it's a piece called And Still I Rise. And it really encapsulates a lot of what I like about his work. He has the ability to deal with themes that relate primarily to Black male identity in the United States, you know, police violence and premature death and the way people are often viewed as a vector of danger or any of the things that we associate with Black men in the society. And he is able to grapple with those questions in all of their seriousness while also injecting a very element of humor into it. Back in June, I went to talk to Fahamu in Atlanta, where I used to live when I taught at Spelman College.
Further down the street, Abernathy turns into Cascade Road, and Cascade Road has long been a community of affluent African-American figures, business leaders, doctors, politicians, etc. So there's a really, really rich Black history in this particular community.
So you think Atlanta has been central to your work? Like, would you have done the same sort of thing in a different place?
I don't know that I would have or could have even. When I really started traveling with my work, I really began to recognize just how unique and beautiful Atlanta was and how influential it had been because of, you know, Atlanta being the city that's always been considered like this Black Mecca. There's been times I've traveled, you know, to cities, you know, and for 2 or 3 days, the only Black person I saw was my reflection in the mirror. Atlanta's really helped me see the beauty in my Blackness and to see the diversity of Blackness, what Blackness can be.
For lunch, we went to a place called R. Thomas. If you live in Atlanta for any period of time, you know that there's not a lot of late night eating options. And R. Thomas is the place that you go after a late night at the club, you know, or just the middle of the night and you decided you're hungry. As a matter of fact, I don't know that I'd ever been there before 11 p.m. until we went to lunch. What do you get here?
Various things. You know, I think another reason that I like coming here, too, is I'm primarily vegan. It also has vegan options. For many years, this was one of the few restaurants in the city where you could go as a vegan and find something that you could eat. So
in Atlanta, that's saying a whole lot. I don't think I've ever met anyone else named Fahamu. As a matter of fact, I know I've never met anyone else named Fahamu. Where does your name come from?
The name is Swahili. It means understanding. My parents were well into the Pan-Africanist movement in the 60s and 70s, you know. So all of my siblings, we all have names from the continent. But when I was maybe like 8 or 9, my dad, who had been institutionalized after my mom died, called. And I had never thought of this before, but he was like, "Do you know what your name means?" And I was like, "My name means something?" You know, and he told me, "Your name means understanding," you know. And that gave me a whole different view on my life at that point. I became really fascinated with anything that had to do with Africa. Like, I wanted to know more.
The fascination with Africa continued and became a theme into his adulthood, and especially as he became an artist. As a matter of fact, you can see that in his new exhibit, Do or Die, which is inspired by the Yoruba and Ifa traditions of West Africa. There's a group of paintings called Egun Dance, and they show a dancing figure and a face mask that's made of small white cowrie shells. The shells symbolize wealth. As a matter of fact, they were once used as currency in West Africa. He's also pairing these august West African spiritual themes with African-American urban motifs. The figure who's dancing is actually wearing a hoodie and sweatpants. And notably, that hoodie and those sweatpants are white. In the Ifa tradition, white symbolizes healing.
In Ifa, you don't die. You transition back into the realm of the ancestors where you are, again, amongst, you know, spirits, you know, and you can return, right? And so there's a kind of power in this idea that your spirit is not ended, right? Your physical form may end, but you continue.
The spirits that he's talking about in the Do or Die series are the spirits of African-American men who've died at the hands of police. And more specifically, Fahamu was responding to the death of Walter Scott in 2015 in North Charleston, South Carolina.
It's specifically created to venerate the spirits of those individuals who've been killed by racial violence. And so it speaks to, you know, young men and boys who've been killed by police violence. It speaks to people who were assassinated during the Civil Rights Movement. It speaks to people who were lynched during Jim Crow era. So you see all the names of these men. They become, they move from being victims to being honored ancestors.
Hi, who are you?
Yeah.
Sure, what are you having?
I think I'm gonna go with the Thai bowl. Yeah, with salmon, you can add salmon. So now we are about to turn onto Oakland Drive, where my new studio is. So I'm kind of on the border of...
During a trip to Havana, Fahamu got a call saying that his studio had caught fire. He lost paintings, he lost materials, and he lost some of his own private art collection. Just this past January, he moved into a new studio, and he showed me around.
And when we pull up, you have to bear with me because I'm going to have to jump out to open the gate. So when I got the building, it still looked like 1956. There was wood paneling everywhere and like those like green tiles that you would have seen in like your school, you know, hallways and stuff like that. So I basically gutted the entire building and kind of redid the inside. So this turned into my office, and I have a little gallery space or showroom here.
When Fahamu was first trying to establish himself as an artist in Atlanta, he worked as a graphic designer and did campaigns for hip-hop artists. Then an idea came to him.
You know, what would happen if somebody marketed a visual artist the same way we do a hip-hop artist?
He came up with this brilliant, unorthodox, and slightly scatological thing, which is actually what first brought him to my attention. He put up posters all around the city of Atlanta with the slogan, Fahamu Piku is the shit.
And the posters just had this, like, graphic illustration of me with no shirt on trying to look real hard and tough. Mm-hmm. And it said, Fahamu Piku is the shit. And on the bottom, paid for by the committee to make Fahamu Piku officially the shit. As soon as I started putting the posters up, like, it was like an immediate, like, reaction. You know, people would come up to me on the street like, hey, man, are you that shit guy?
This idea of promoting himself led to a series of paintings of him on the cover of art magazines. He was satirizing hip-hop to a certain extent, but he was also making fun of an art world that he felt excluded from.
I very deliberately created, like, these magazine covers, like, using magazine covers like Art Forum and Art News and Art in America, and these very, like, high-profile, sort of, like, you know, uppity, you know, kinds of publications, but juxtaposing it with this character that I created and, like, a whole bunch of, like, swag and, like, attitude and, you know, crotch grabbing and throwing up the middle finger and stuff like that. And, you know, and I tell people all the time, because people are like, you only paint yourself. And I'm like, I don't paint myself at all. Mm-hmm. I use my body, mm-hmm. but it's not me. People see me or they engage with me and they realize that, okay, wait, this, yeah, that looks like him, but that's not the same. Mm-hmm. That happens everywhere I go. They're like, oh, you're actually quiet. Oh, you're not as tall as I thought you would be. Oh, you're actually smart. You know what I mean? Like, what you know, so that's always kind of fascinating.
So there are some themes that jump out at you with his work. Black identity, masculinity, violence, celebrity culture. But there are other themes to his work that I think aren't as easily apparent. I, for instance, knew that his work came from a very personal place in addition to his political convictions. In fact, his first show, which was his senior thesis project at the Atlanta College of Art, deals with his memories of an intensely traumatic moment in his childhood.
When I was 4 years old, my father, who was suffering from schizophrenia, had an episode and he ended up killing my mom. And my siblings and I were all present at the time. We were all there. We were all, you know, basically witness to it. And after, you know, father, you know, did what he did, he ran out of the room. He told us to run, like it's time to run. And he marched us all to the police station and went to the desk sergeant, told him what he did and turned himself in. You know, my siblings and I were kind of taken away and we were for a little while wards of the state. And then we were, sent off to live with relatives in South Carolina. You know, no one ever talked to us about that. There was never any, like, counseling. There was no, you know, how do you feel? Like, no one said, like, it was like nobody said anything. We, you know, it was just like, your dad killed your mom and that's it, you know.
So you remember that moment from when you were four?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's like the first and one of the most vivid memories that I have.
When Fahamu was a junior in college, he found himself listening to Goody Mob's album Soul Food.
And on that album is a song called Guess Who? And in that song, everybody in the group talks about the impact of their mother's love and how their mother's love saved them or, you know, helped them through their lives. My mom, destination unknown. Without on her own, she was barely even grown and became my mom. I never knew my dad, so even when the times got bad. And as I said, you know, I lost my mom at four, but I always felt her hand in everything that I did. But she's still my mom. It still amazed me. The Lord had to help her raise me, judging from the way I used to be. And I remember that I had this box. It's like wooden box. And I remember that box used to sit in the corner of my room. So as I'm just kind of picked up this box and I start, like, making, you know, and, you know, creating something.
the first to hold you in some arms, the first to change your diaper when your stomach wasn't calm.
And when I kind of came out of whatever thing I was in, whatever zone I was in front of me I had turned this box into Minkisi. So Minkisis are these vessels that house spirits. And so I turned this box into a Minkisi that represented my mom's spirit. And it sent me down this rabbit hole because now I'm like, there's something to this. Like I felt a kind of a little lighter after I created that.
He never really talked with his siblings about that night. But the next time he saw them, he got them to write down what they remembered about the night their mother died.
When I got back to school, I began to take those stories that they had shared with me and make this body of work that retold the story of the night that my mom died, but from the perspective of each of the four of us. And that became my senior exhibition. Anyway, the night that the show opened, I saw, you know, people come in and they're reading the stories and they're looking at the work and, you know, and I'm watching people react to this work. I mean, people crying, you know, people were coming up to me like, hey, you know, I haven't spoken to my brother in 15 years and your work has made me want to reach out and reconnect and heal that. Or, you know, I was abused as a child and your work has given me the courage to, you know, to face that. And I remember standing back, watching and realizing this is art. Mm. This is what I want to do. Like, and that's how I kind of discovered my voice as an artist through that experience.
Has your father seen your work?
Yeah, yeah. He hasn't seen that work in particular, but, you know, my father has been institutionalized since, you know, since that time. But in 2010, I had this show in New York and reached out to my father because we had, at that point, had developed a relationship where we, you know, spoke over the phone and stuff like that. And he was able to get permission and was escorted to the gallery to see the show. But he was really moved by it, and I never forget, he was like, your mother would be really proud of you, you know? Yeah.
Artist Fahamu Peku talking in Atlanta with The New Yorker's Jelani Cobb. A show of Peku's work called Do or Die is at the African American Museum in Philadelphia. Next week on the show, we're going to be talking about some of our favorite reads for the summer. Jelani Cobb will share a few tips on books of history that you should be looking out for. We'll talk with the crime writer Tana French. And Gia Tolentino is going to compare notes with Rivka Galchin about the children's books they loved when they were kids. Hope you'll join us for that. Now today, we've been celebrating the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, and before we go, I wanted to share one more thing with you.
Traveling to the moon was way less complicated this year than it was back in 1969, as the four of us proved, not that anyone gives a whoop.
That voice, if you didn't quite catch it, was the voice of Tom Hanks. A few years ago, Hanks wrote a story about four misfits who came up with their own 21st century do-it-yourself approach for space travel. It's called Alan Bean Plus Four.
Since four of us would be a-coming around the moon, I needed to make room inside the Alan Bean and eliminate pounds. We'd have no mission control to boss us around, so I ripped out all the comm. I replaced every bolt, screw, hinge, clip, and connector with duct tape. $3 a roll at Home Depot. Our privy was a shower curtain for privacy. I've heard from an experienced source that a trip to the John in zero gravity requires that you strip naked and give yourself half an hour, so yeah, privacy was key. I replaced the outer opening hatch and its bulky lock evac apparatus with a steel alloy plug that had a big window and a self-sealing bib. In the vacuum of space, the air pressure inside the Allen Bean would force the hatch closed and airtight. Simple physics. Announce that you are flying to the moon, and everyone assumes you be to land on it. To plant the flag, kangaroo hop in 1/6 gravity, and collect rocks to bring home. None of which we were going to do. We were flying around the moon. Landing is a whole different ballgame, and as for stepping out onto the surface, hell, choosing which of the four of us would get out first to become the 13th person to leave bootprints up there would have led to so much bad blood that our crew would have broken up long before T-minus 10 seconds and counting. Assembling the three stages of the good ship Alan Bean took 2 days. We packed granola bars and water in squeeze-top bottles, then pumped in the liquid oxygen for the two booster stages and the hypergolic chemicals for the one-shot firing of the translunar motor, the mini-rocket that would fling us to our lunar rendezvous. Most of Oxnard came around to Steve Wong's driveway to ogle the Alan Bean, not a one of them knowing who Alan Bean was or why we'd named the rocket ship after him. The kids begged for peeks inside the spacecraft, but we didn't have the insurance. What are you waiting for? You gonna blast off soon? To every knothead who would listen, I explained launch windows and trajectories, showing them on my Moon Phase app, free, how we had to intersect the moon's orbit at exactly the right moment, or lunar gravity would, hell, there's the moon, point your rocket at it and put on a show. 24 seconds after clearing the tower, our first stage was burning all stops, and the Max-Q app, 99 cents, showed us pulling 11.8 times our weight at sea level. Not that we needed iPhones to tell us this. We were fighting for breath with Anna screaming, "Get off my chest!" But no one was on her chest. She was, in fact, sitting on me, crushing me like a lap dance from an offensive lineman. Kaboom went M-Dash's dynamite bolts and the second stage fired as programmed. A minute later, dust, loose change, and a couple of ballpoint pens floated up from behind our seats, signaling, hey, we'd achieved orbit.
That's Tom Hanks reading an excerpt from his short story, Alan Bean Plus Four, which was published in 2014. You can hear him read the entire story on the podcast of the New Yorker Radio Hour, or you can find it at newyorker.com. I'm David Remnick, and that's our show for today. Thanks for joining us, and have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado and L.D. Brown. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Avi Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Keegan Zima, Meng-Fei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.